My name is Nathaniel Deakins, registration number 38752, and I represent Alberto Martinez. Subject to your questions, I will discuss the testimonial nature of Mr. Shields' statements to Officer Walker. These statements were introduced at my client's trial in violation of his confrontation rights.
Are you abandoning the issue about the juror, given the state's position that there was no exhaustion of peremptories?
No, Your Honor. The objective circumstances of this encounter, this discussion, indicate that the primary purpose of the discussion was to establish or prove past events potentially relevant to later criminal investigation or prosecution. I'll point this court to several factors, including Mr. Shields knows that he's making a testimonial statement. Officer Walker is attempting to formalize statements from witnesses and solve a crime, and there is no ongoing emergency. In that respect, this case is different than Michigan v. Bryant.
How do we know there was no ongoing emergency, or I guess more precisely, how is the officer to know there is no ongoing emergency? He arrives at the scene, there is a victim who is covered in blood, cut up, he has no indication of who did what, if that person might be at large. How is the officer to know that based upon the circumstances as they existed at the time?
First, I'd like to just point out briefly that I think that the ongoing emergency is a bit of a red herring in this particular case, although it is a relevant factor. There was an ongoing emergency. If you look at Officer Walker's testimony, you'll see that he says, I arrived at the scene, he was flagged down, he got out of his car, immediately saw a crutch, a broken bottle, and a trail of blood leading to the victim was lying outside of this restaurant with numerous people around him. He called for an ambulance, the ambulance arrived, and took the victim away, caring for the victim. Other officers arrived on the scene, and Mr. Shields approached him and said, I saw everything. So this case is distinguishable from Michigan v. Bryant in terms of an ongoing emergency, in that the victim was being treated by medical services. The weapon, the weapon in this case was a bottle, as well as fists and hands, allegedly. But the bottle lay broken at the scene, with a trail of blood indicating that was the weapon, and Officer Walker saw that immediately.
Pardon me, counsel, but he doesn't know who the perpetrators were. He doesn't know why this attack occurred. He doesn't know whether this is some focused attack on this victim that won't be repeated, or an unfocused attack that may be repeated down the road in 20 minutes. So why is that not evidence to indicate that there's an ongoing emergency?
We've got to be careful not to interpret ongoing emergency so broadly that every single case will fit that scenario.
Well, but I understand, and I agree with you. Certainly every case does not. But is it fair to say that the officer, when he came upon the scene, knew that there had been a violent assault?
From the evidence that he saw, there was indicia of that. I think he had it pretty well figured out in a general sense.
And then is it fair to say that he had no idea how it happened?
I don't think that's fair to say, Your Honor.
Well, did he know whether the assailant knew the victim or not?
Well, that particular fact, perhaps not. But I think the scene speaks for itself in that, again, I mean, not to belabor the point, but the weapon lay broken at the scene. There was a trail of blood leading to this crowd.
How did he know that was a weapon? How did he know that the broken glass reflected the weapon?
Well, that's what he said at trial. Well, that's what he said he observed immediately upon
the scene. Broken glass.
And the victim was cut.
Right.
And we also have no affirmative evidence that the perpetrators are at large with another weapon, as you do in Bryant, where the person is shot at the scene and the victim says, hey, this guy's still on the loose with a gun. We don't have any evidence of that here.
But we do have. Isn't that the problem from the officer's standpoint? He doesn't have any evidence one way or the other. He doesn't know. There could have been other weapons. He doesn't know who the assailant is. He doesn't know if the assailant is part of the crowd that's standing there. He doesn't know if the assailant has run off. He just doesn't know.
Well, there are certainly some things he doesn't know. There are certainly some things that he can gather from his observations of the scene. And this is why I feel like I want to focus not only on the emergency, potential emergency, but also on some other very important factors, which is the testimonial intent of Mr. Shields, whether or not there's an ongoing emergency. And this is why the ongoing emergency could potentially swallow the confrontation clause here if there's an ongoing emergency exception.
But do we look at the intent of the person giving the statement, or don't we look at objectively what the officer would perceive?
No, I think it's extremely important to look at the declarant, the statements that the declarant made under the circumstances which they were made to determine the primary purpose.
But the Fourth Amendment isn't directed at the conduct of the declarant. The Fourth Amendment is directed at the conduct of the officer. Okay, we have to look at it from the officer's perspective.
I don't think that's true, Your Honor. The Sixth Amendment is...
Sixth Amendment, excuse me.
No, the Sixth Amendment is framed in terms of the witnesses against the accused. In that respect, it's very much framed at the declarant. Because Mr. Shields here, Mr. Shields is the witness. That's why it's...
But the analysis is, objectively, what is happening from the officer's perspective, it seems to me, not objectively what is happening from some witness's perspective who may have seen what was going on. Sure, it's a confrontation clause issue, but
no.
When we're looking here for we're looking here at what would a person arriving on the scene perceive the situation to be, and that determines whether the statement is testimonial or not.
I don't think that's the correct analysis, Your Honor. I think that Crawford itself says one of the core class of statements that are testimonial are statements given by a declarant under circumstances indicating that that person would reasonably expect them to be used later in an investigation or prosecution. I think it's very... Bryant teaches us, and going back to Davis, teaches us that testimonial, to determine the statement as testimonial, you've got to look at many different things. But clearly one of the most important things is the declarant's state of mind, the declarant's motive.
But what is the primary purpose?
But
that can change. If say the declarant is me, the judge, and I happen to see a crime, I might very well know when I'm making a statement that in addition to providing the officer with information he needs at the scene, that my statements may be admissible in court later, they may be used later. That's my state of mind. You're saying we have to inquire into the state of mind of each individual, and the analysis might turn on who the witness is, not the objective circumstances, but who the witness is and what that particular witness knows about the judicial system.
I think that's perfectly relevant, yes. I think that the purpose of the officer is relevant too. I didn't mean to imply that only the declarant state of mind or circumstances of the declarant are important, but it's very important, as well as the officer. And I think if you look at the record and what Officer Walker said he was doing was, he was separating witnesses from non-witnesses. And he said that what we do is we try to get these witnesses to give a verbal statement and then a written statement. And his actions and words indicate that his goal was to get a written statement from Mr. Shields. So,
but the court excluded the written statement, so we don't have an issue about that because the court determined that was testimonial.
That's correct. The written statement didn't come in.
Right.
However, that shows Officer Walker's intent.
It shows the intent in getting the written statement. I mean, there was a passage of time. He took the witness into the restaurant to sit down, and there was later a written statement. But that doesn't really bear upon the initial statements, the verbal statements at the scene.
Well, it shows his intent.
It shows his intent later in getting a written statement.
No, it shows his intent at the time that he said, what we do is we try to get verbal statements and then written statements. And I was actively trying to separate witnesses from non-witnesses. He was trying to solve the crime. There was no evidence of perpetrators.
You perceive that there can only be one intent here, that he must be, if he's attempting to, as you put it, solve the crime, he's not also attempting to determine whether there is a perpetrator on the loose. He might have both in mind.
He may. Right? I won't concede that, but his primary purpose is to record statements for a later investigation or prosecution. But look, Mr. Shields is...
Counsel,
Mr. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm concerned that your analysis would completely swallow the sort of public safety approach that is one of the factors that we're supposed to look at. Because certainly, when all police officers go to a chaotic scene, they want to find out what happened. But part of their presence there is not merely as the cold detectives recreating it. They have a public safety obligation, too. And at a scene like this, part of the public safety obligation is to determine if there is a threat out there to other people that they're going to have to try to do their best in the game, isn't it?
I think that is one of the hats that police officers wear. However, we're looking at the statements that Mr. Shields made to Officer Walker under the circumstances that they were made. Whether there were other non-testimonial statements made at that scene, that could be true. But taking everything into consideration, Officer Walker's purpose, Mr. Shields' purpose, the discussion that was made, Mr. Shields approaching Officer Walker and saying, "Hey, I saw everything." Look, if Mr. Shields was so scared, why did he follow these guys around the corner? Why did he wait at the scene? Why did he go up to Officer Walker? He singled him out. He said, "I saw everything." Now, he had some hesitations about cooperating with the police, about giving a statement, because he knew that it was going to be used later in the investigation. He knew that it would potentially tie into this criminal justice process. He was giving evidence. He knew it. That's what Officer Walker was looking for, and that's what was given.
Or he thought they were still running around with broken bottles and he was next, which would be exactly what the emergency situation is.
But I just don't think that is borne out by the record, Your Honor. The prosecution was trying to lay the foundation for an excited utterance exception. They were saying, or Officer Walker was saying, he was scared. If he was so scared, why did he... This is Shields. If Shields was so scared, why did he follow these men around the corner and watch this happen? If he was so scared, why did he wait at the scene for the police? If he was so scared, why did he single Officer Walker out and give a statement about what happened? He didn't make a cry for help. He didn't say, you know, these guys are after me. He didn't say anything about
it. Well, I could come up with an explanation for all of that. It's a crowd at the scene. There's strength in numbers. I think there's again, we're hypothesizing, and the officer doesn't have any idea what the facts are. If I see somebody attacked by an assailant, but I come to the scene with 20 other people and crowd around the victim, I might feel fairly safe that one person isn't going to come back and try to, get the rest of us. Like I say, there can be explanations for all this, but isn't that why we have the public safety exception? We don't know. The officer just doesn't know. I mean, he's got a victim, a fresh crime. He has no idea where the assailant is.
Well, Your Honor, respectfully, there's no public safety exception. I think that the ongoing emergency factor is an important part of this analysis. But again, that looking at it from that perspective, I mean, you have the potential to swallow the confrontation clause, right? I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal if that's okay.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. And may it please the court. My name is Carmen Molina, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. My attorney registration is 34852. And I'll go directly into the testimonial confrontation claim and hopefully answer your questions. Let me lay out the standard or the legal standards laid out in Michigan v. Bryan. The testimonial inquiry is whether the circumstances of the interaction between the officer and the declarant, in this case, objectively indicated that the primary purpose of the interrogation, and I'm using interrogation, is using a colloquial sense, was to enable police assistance to meet an ongoing emergency. The inquiry is not the subjective, nor even the actual purpose of the participants, but rather the purpose that a reasonable person would have had, as ascertained by the statements and the actions of the participants, as well as the circumstances in which the encounter occurred.
A reasonable person in the position of the declarant.
As I read Bryant, Your Honor, seems in the position of the participants included the officers and also the, in this case, was a witness. It wasn't the victim. So here, when the officer arrived, he arrived shortly after the assault. The victim was still on the ground, bleeding profusely. The officer, even I think the officer testified that he started to have seizures. 2 minutes after he arrived, the declarant approached the officer and said, "I saw everything, but he was scared and he was torn and didn't want to talk." But he provided a statement right there publicly outside the restaurant, and there is no indication there was any formality. And in fact, the officer only said, "Quickly, tell me what happened." And I think that it was brief and it was necessary for the officer to assess the situation and also if there was any danger for the police or the public in general.
Did the officer make any notes of what the declarant told him?
Not, I don't think he made, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that from the record, but it doesn't appear that he made notes of what he said.
At the time. Later he wrote a report.
Exactly. But that report is not before this court. So, and also, again, as I said, there was a potential danger, but it doesn't matter whether in hindsight or after everything happened, it doesn't matter whether there was no real danger or whether there was no emergency. We are looking, this is an objective standard, and this is the reasonable person. It doesn't matter whether there was an emergency. But nobody knew, as you said, nobody knew where the assailants were, and nobody really knew where what the motives were. So considering all the circumstances of the encounter, the statements, and the police brief telling what happened, I think the objectively, the primary, and again, primary doesn't have to be the only one, the primary purpose of the quick tell me what happened was kind of to facilitate police assistance to meet the ongoing emergency. Do you have any questions?
I have a question about the standard of review for that.
Yes.
Question. Are we to look at the testimony and decide ourselves whether that objective test has been met without any deference to what the trial court found, or is there any deference involved here?
Deference? The trial court in this case found that these things were not non-testimonial. They did not have this Ryan case, the 2011 case, so this happened after. So the trial court found that the statements were non-testimonial and found that under they were unexcited utterance and therefore did not qualify as hearsay.
Correct. And my question is that a factual finding as to whether it is testimonial or not, or is that a legal question? To what aspects of the court's findings do we defer, to what aspects do we not defer and review de novo?
Okay, so I guess the conclusion that they were non-testimonial would be a legal conclusion, and you review de novo. And again, the underlying facts, finding that there was this excited utterance, I think you can use that as a factual determination, which you get deference. The court found that the client made a statement shortly after the assault, and he was scared, he was torn, and he approached the officer. He told the officer, "I saw everything." So there's also, record to support the trial court conclusion that it was an excited utterance. He wanted to talk, he was scared, and he provided the statement right there at the scene. And the fact that the police asking quickly, tell me what happened, despite the fact that he was scared and did not want to talk, does not prevent or I think the status of an excited utterance, because I think there's enough in the record to support that he made the statements kind of in as a reaction to a traumatic event and not as part of a reflective thought process. So as to those factual determination, this for the first and the fact that it was non-testimonial is a novel, and that's your review. Any other question on the non-testimonial, on the confrontation thing?
How much time passed from the time he gave the quote-unquote verbal statement to the time of his written statement?
Well, I don't really know from the record, but again, the officer said that 2 minutes after he arrived,
got the verbal statement.
Got the verbal, right. And then shortly after that,
right.
He was able to bring it because he wanted to use the restroom, the client.
Oh, right.
Okay. So I don't think it was much more than another 2 to 5 minutes. Another point I wanted to make, Your Honors, even if this court were to find that there was error, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The statements were cumulative of and corroborated by at least the testimony of two witnesses. These witnesses provided essentially and materially the same testimony. The group started a verbal altercation, and then the individual wearing a yellow polo shirt is the one who hit the victim and slashed her head and hands. And then the rest of the group kicked and punched the victim. And also the defendant was described as the assailant wearing a striped shirt. So, and also, Your Honors, the prosecution, I don't think the statements were a big part of the prosecution's case, because the prosecution did not even mention this during its closing argument. The defense counsel was able and, in fact, thoroughly cross-examined the officer. And overall, the prosecution's case was very strong because the evidence of guilt was overwhelming.
Was the jury instructed on a complicitor theory?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think he was, but I might be wrong. I think he was convicted of just second degree assault and third degree assault. The second degree assault wasn't the male victim, and the third degree assault was the female, but he's not challenging the third degree assault.
And but if the jury wasn't instructed on complicitor, the additional statement that the officer testified to, which is that he saw them conferring in the alley, I'm paraphrasing, would be irrelevant because the fact that they maybe had made an agreement presumably to assault, it seems irrelevant.
Yes, and I pointed out in my brief, in fact, I think he was charged initially as a conspirator in the first degree assault, but those charges were dismissed before trial. Mm-hmm. So unless you have any other questions, Your Honor? That people ask that this for affirmative conviction. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Was the jury instructed on complicitor theory?
Yes, they were. That was the primary theory of the prosecution. He was charged with first degree assault. Prosecution submitted complicity theory, argued that up, and said in closing, well, if you don't, based on paraphrasing here, if you don't find him guilty of first-degree assault, you can find him guilty of second-degree assault as a complicitor.
And yeah, but that was just on one charge, right? The charge relating to the girlfriend, there wasn't a complicity theory. It was
No, yes. Okay. We're not challenging that.
Okay.
He was convicted of second-degree assault, intent to cause bodily injury, caused serious bodily injury. Now, serious bodily injury in this case was the bottle assault and the... And what the, that so, I think prejudice is established here. I do wish I had a little more time, but the standard, with just with respect to the standard of review, Your Honor, it is de novo. Now, factual conclusions are generally reviewed for clear error. The trial court drew a line here and relied on the fact that Officer Walker was trying to identify the perpetrators. I don't see any evidence of that. I see Officer Walker trying to separate witnesses and record statements. Now, the fact is, a man came up sometime during this whole event, 5, 6, 7 minutes in, and said, hey, I think there's some suspects a couple blocks away. They got lucky. But Officer Walker didn't, there's no evidence that he was searching for perpetrators. This is, let's say, a typical crime scene, but he's not expecting to find perpetrators. He doesn't seem to be expressing any worry that there's anybody on the loose. And again, I would focus the court's attention on multiple factors, especially the declarant's testimonial intent as well as Officer Walker's intent. If there are no further questions, I ask this court to reverse the judgment of conviction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Case will stand submitted. We'll issue an opinion in due course. That concludes.